Welcome to the Deaf Studies podcast, a podcast dedicated to the breadth and diversity of voices in and around the academic field of deaf studies.
With your hosts, Dr. Renske Visser and Dr. Bethan Michael Fox. Let's get started.
Happy May, Dr. Renske Visser. How are you doing?
Happy May. I am doing well. The last week of April is always quite hectic at the embassy, because some people might know, but the 27th of April is King's Day in the Netherlands, which is always a big celebration. We celebrate the birthday of our king. So when we used to have a queen, we celebrated Queen's Day, and her birthday was on the 30th of April. So it's only moved like 3 days backwards a few years ago when she abdicated. And so, yeah, I'm recovering from those celebrations at work, and also at Dutch school. We always have a big King's Day celebration where, so in a part of Espoo in Finland, there's all of us dressed in orange. So if any Finnish people walk by, that's slightly odd. And then today, the 1st of May in Finland, as in other many other places of the world, in Finland, it's called Vappu. It's May Day, and it's like Labor Day. So there's big parades, and it's a red day. That means a day off for everyone to celebrate all the workers and laborers. How is life at your end?
Well, you've just been partying up, haven't you? I enjoyed the protest of everyone dressed in orange. That was good fun to look at. Yesterday, because we're recording at the end of April, I went to Falmouth Pride. That was super fun and nice to go to. And yeah, I think we've just been talking a lot in the last few days about how busy things are getting. I mean, it's always busy in academia, is it not? And by the way, listeners, Renske is currently touching her face, and guess what colour her nails are painted? So orange. And May, just for where I work, there's like a lot of student hand-in. There's sort of things often kind of where students maybe need some support this point in the year that can kind of come to a head. There's research deadlines creeping up, all the things that you thought you would have had finished by May that you realize that you're so behind on start to emerge. And for me, there's often a lot of rejigging of things and thinking, okay, I was maybe unrealistic with how much time I thought I would have for that, and I might need to move this or move that. I've got a meeting tomorrow for one project in particular where I just have not been able to dedicate the time I would like to it. One of my sisters has been telling me about this Gretchen Rubin's The Four Tendencies. It's like another personality typing system. Anyone who listens knows I love the personality typing system. And one of them is like the idea that you might be a bit of an obliger. And sometimes if something is the deadline is just for you, it gets pushed to the bottom of the pile. If it's for somebody else, it always gets done and it gets done on time. But if you're the person it's accountable to, that's less like, and I resonate with that for sure. Are you feeling behind on anything as we enter May, Red?
Definitely. I think because we do the podcast together, there's an episode every month. But as you know, I'm trying to move my blog, Dead Good Reading, to another server. And it's just, yeah, that's at the bottom right now, even though I love it so much doing that. But it's low on the list of priorities because of everything else. And we'll probably return to this at the end with the outro recording as well. But yeah, the notion of slow academia that our guest today is talking about is something that I would like to live up to more and appreciate more. We've had a number of episodes now on quite a heavy topic on suicide, and a previous episode with Mike Alvarez. On the back of that, Alessandra Seghi reached out to us to let us know that she is also working on suicide, and her book Youth and Suicide in American Cinema: Context, Causes and Consequences is published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2022, and she sent us a lovely audio clip to talk a bit about the book, and perhaps in the future we'll also get her on the podcast. So if you want to know more about that book, listen to her now.
Hello, listeners of the Deaf Studies podcast. I'm Alessandra Seghi, a multidisciplinary scholar working at the intersection of the social sciences and media. I'd like to tell you about my multi-year research, which culminated in my book, Youth and Suicide in American Cinema, published by Palgrave Macmillan at the end of 2022. In the book, I investigate how youth and suicide have been portrayed in American films from the very beginning all the way to 2019. My research shows that the portrayal of youth and suicide in film is complex. It's often controversial, or at least unbalanced, inconsistent, limited, and at times flatly simplistic. Other times it can be stifling in its brutal honesty, yet rich and thought-provoking. So I advocate for young audiences to think for themselves and question the media. I want to empower youth to be engaged film audiences and film creators. And I also want to challenge the dominant understanding of youth cinema as well as the production of youth cinema. All in all, my book is significant on several fronts. First of all, this study is crucial to understanding the messages about suicide that films convey, as well as the related dynamics and strains in social relationships. This is especially important given the alarming statistics about youth suicide and the unrecognized public health crisis that comes with it. Second, in addition to the analysis, I offer a solution, a proactive approach, a media literacy strategy for young audiences. This makes all the more sense the more complex and multi-layered media products have become. Third, with my proactive approach, I encourage young audiences to also specifically become media makers. This is a major step, since, frankly, youth, just like the elderly, have rarely been in control of the media products that talk about them. I'm Alessandra Seggi, author of Youth and Suicide in American Cinema, Context, Causes, and Consequences. Thank you.
And then today we have a wonderful guest, and we're so excited that today we are talking to Yasmin Gunaratnam, and she is a sociologist interested in how different types of inequality and injustice are produced, lived with, and remade, and how these processes create new forms of local and global inclusion and dispossession. Yasmin is also a yoga teacher, exploring contemplative social justice and embodied pedagogies. Her publications include Researching Race and Ethnicity, Methods, Knowledge, and Power, and another book, Death and the Migrant, and the co-authored book, Go Home, The Politics of Immigration Controversies, which was published by Manchester University Press. And if you would like to follow her on Twitter, she tweets at Jasmin Gunn, G-U-N. Enjoy this episode.
A very warm welcome to the podcast. We're absolutely delighted to have you here. So you're very well known in the field of death studies for your seminal work on transnational dying and end-of-life care in cities, which we understand began with your PhD in the 1990s, sparked by having cared for your parents in your 20s. Would you please tell us a bit about your doctoral research and the book that then resulted from that?
Yes, thank you also for inviting me to participate in this conversation. That first question is going to take me back quite a long way. It's also a story that I've told in different ways, so it changes as well, not only because of who I'm speaking to, but my own understanding of that time, like all of our memories and sense making, is always happening. I guess the highlights, the top notes of that story are I came out of a background, I guess, in sociology, and particularly I was working on violence against women then, finished my degree and was going to have a year off. And in that year, my father was brain damaged as a result of cardiac bypass surgery. And then my life and the lives of my family turned around, So I spent the next seven and a half, we spent the next 7.5 years caring for him. And in that time, obviously, I was getting more involved just because of how our lives were in health and social care. There was a carers movement at that time, but very white. So some of the issues that we were going through and experiencing, I wasn't seeing really being written about or discussed. So it was a complete turnaround, but it happened over a period of time. I was at that time, you know, very involved in the women's movement as well, particularly South Asian women's organizing in the UK. So I was quite politically literate and an activist, and that carried on really throughout. And then my father died, and 6 months later, my mother died as well. So it was a very intense period. Their deaths were very different. I should say both also worked for the NHS. And this is really, really important in terms of connecting up the personal with the structural and the political. So they died young. Both died when they were 62. They were working really, really hard. And for me, that is absolutely related to their sort of premature deaths, but they had very different deaths as well. So my father died in the hospital where he worked, a general hospital in South London. And my mum was able to die at home under the care of St. Christopher's Hospice, which for some people listening will ring a lot of bells. It's iconic in terms of the story that the hospice movement tells about itself. So St. Christopher's was seen as sparking the modern hospice movement. And I didn't know any of this at the time. You know, I just happened to live in the catchment area of the hospice. And they were absolutely amazing. So my mum was a nurse and very, very direct in terms of how she wanted to die. She was being looked after in our local hospital, and they had put us in touch with St. Christopher's. And everything in British hospitals, or perhaps in all hospitals, is quite rushed. You're very aware of the time you're taking up, so you start to tell edited stories. You know, you learn what the main things to tell professionals are. And I really remember now very, very vividly the first visit that the home care nurse made to us at home. And she was there for 1.5 hours. And it was just the most exquisite listening and attentiveness. And she, of course, had to ask questions. And one of the questions she asked my mum was about her long-term goals, what she wanted in her care. And I remember my mum being very clear. So three words that I remember really well. And my mum said, a dignified exit. And that is exactly what she got. So she was able to die at home. So St. Christopher's coordinates the care. So it's delivered by local care professionals, district nurses, as they were called then. And my mum was able to die without pain, which is rare, I think. So I was incredibly, incredibly grateful for that. And then at the same time, I was witnessing and experiencing this sublime care. I was also aware that there was a whole side of our experiences that the care wasn't addressing. And again, this speaks to low expectations. So, you know, you don't expect people to be thinking about cultural difference or how that might manifest or how previous experiences might make you more closed down when it comes to, you know, official services or anybody coming into your home, really. So that was how my interest in palliative care started. And I should say also, there was a huge openness at St. Christopher's. So I was working around health at the time, and I just produced this report for the King's Fund, which was guidance to health service managers on how to implement race equality. And I sent that to who was then the chief executive of St. Christopher's. And I basically said, you provide great care, it's a great service, but it could be better. To their credit, I mean, I was just nobody really. So I'd sent this in and the chief executive said, come in and talk to us. And that's how my research, I guess, really started. So it was before my PhD that I was thinking about these issues. And for all people, I think research can often start with an unease, you know, questions, things you're not sure about. And that's how my research started. Well, maybe I should also go back to a very particular point in that question when you said about my research in terms of end-of-life care in cities. And I think that's really important. So most of my research and some of the teaching and training I do has really been in British cities, often in London. And there's something about Britain's post-war experience that is really important to that. So what I was going through was really a bigger issue, a structural issue, which was the starting of the death and dying of Britain's post-war migrants. So they were starting to come into spaces like hospices then and into palliative care. So I was witnessing the dying of this sort of first generation of post-war migrants. So what I was going through in terms of questions that my parents' death raised, so why was I here? Did I belong? And I was even thinking, I came to this country from Sri Lanka when I was 5, and if that wasn't my decision. And when my parents died, I was starting to think, do I belong here? Where do I belong? All those questions, which are really, again, not personal questions. They say something about the political economy of empire and colonialism. So the cities part is really important because I think what some of the migrants were doing, most migrants post-war from the Commonwealth, in inverted commas, countries came to cities. And there was something that was very pioneering about what these adventurers were doing. I've been recently rereading Sadia Hartman's wonderful book, Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments. And she's charting through archival research the movement, which was called the Great Migration, post-slavery of people in the south from rural areas to cities in the north of North America. She's particularly talking about young women and femmes and queer folk and how they reinvented lives in the new spaces of so-called liberation in the cities. And I was struck by something of a resonance between what the Commonwealth, in inverted commas again, migrants were doing when they came into cities and how cities can afford a certain space for reinvention or playing or trying out different things. The fact that my work was located in cities, I think, is something I don't really want to lose sight of. It's very important for that biographical moment.
Thank you so much. Thanks for sharing the experiences with us, as well as the importance of your research, and that the it's nice sometimes to reflect on the bits that feel really important to us as well, that sometimes can be lost then when people are encountering it in different ways and different disciplines. Now, one of the articles that you've written that we've read in preparation for this interview is the discussion that you have with Ali Asa in their journal Mortality. It was like a conversation, a dialogue between the two of you. And in that, you've written about how you have to continually remind yourself to be patient with writing, often finding it painfully troublesome and slow. And we know that many of our listeners here on the Death Studies podcast will, I think, be reassured to hear that, because I think it's an experience that can be quite shared by many in academia. And We wondered if you could talk to us a bit more about this. You've also stated when writing up your PhD into a book that you needed time to live with the stories, to learn how to move past the convenience of their most obvious outer shells, making space for their nooks and shading. And you've already spoken to us today about the different ways that stories could be told or made sense of. So could you tell us a bit more about the idea of how the stories can emerge in different ways, and maybe just your writing process in general, and how you get past the painful and slow bits?
Painful is just the apt word. I find writing very, very, very difficult. Takes me a long time. There's a beautiful essay by Zadie Smith in her collection, Changing My Mind, and it's about some of the process of writing. And she talks about basically two sorts of ways of approaching writing. So they're the macro planners, and they're the people who have the big plans, and they know basically what's going to go into each paragraph. And then the micro planners, which is you just start with a sentence and go from there. And so I generally have a sense of what I'm going to write, but I have really very little idea about how I'm going to get there. So I am one of those people that starts with the first sentence, and I find it very hard to jump around. So I have to, you know, it's the bricklaying process that Zadie Smith talks about. So you put down one bit and then you go on to the next. And writing just takes me a really, really long time. And this is really important to talk about, I think. I was listening ages ago to a famous writer talking about how he writes, and somebody said, oh, you know, you seem to write so easily. And he said, yeah, I do. I sort of cut a vein and a word drops out one drop at a time. That really struck me as well. I spend a long time choosing words. I have to really think about words. Don't come easily to me. Even in talking, I'm having to really think, put a lot of effort into thinking about finding the right word. So my process is really slow. I think it's chaotic. And after all this time, there's no shortcuts for me. So I've tried different techniques. And I think I've just come to the realization that this is me. You know, this is how I write. I've also cut down on my writing a lot. I write very little these days, but I want what I write to be of a better quality. There's so much writing out there. You know, every time I go into a bookshop, I really sort of ask myself whether the world needs another book. So my last book, my sole authored book, was in 2013, which was Death and the Migrant. And that came out, that was my post-PhD book, I think. So that came out, I finished my PhD in 1999. And then that came out in 2013. So it was a really long process. And Beth, mentioned me talking about having to live with the stories. And again, I think this is really important, maybe for early career researchers or, you know, others who have finished projects to think about, is that sometimes understanding doesn't come when the funding's finished or, you know, when you've handed in your PhD. And for me, if I'd written the post-PhD book, it would have been rubbish. There was so much I didn't understand. So I was going back to listening to people talking, because obviously I transcribed everything myself. And that gives you a sense, I think, of what's happened sometimes in an interview. So I used to transcribe quite late at night so it was very quiet. And just listening to people talking gives you a different sense than when you're reading a transcript. But also our lives change. So there's somebody I end the book with. He chose the name for himself, Ibrahim, who was a refugee. And at that time when I interviewed him, he had an 18-month-old son And he was talking to me about how he had this plan to be buried in Ghana. And he was really talking about a kind of morbid umbilicus, you know, that his death and then being buried in Ghana would be a sort of a lifeline, a posthumous lifeline. And he said, my son will then have a link to Ghana. You know, he'll be able to go and visit me. And that was his way of giving his son some sense of home, in inverted commas, and cultural belonging. And it was very painful at the time as well for me to hear these stories. But I didn't fully understand what that pain was like until I had a son a little while later and he was coming to that age. And just thinking about what it must be like to know that you wouldn't be around at that time. And they were refugees. They were incredibly poor. And I sort of followed up with the social worker what had happened, and they didn't have the money to bury the body in Ghana. And so I've often wondered about what happened to Ibrahim's son, who's mainly, I think, an enigma for me. You know, I have fantasies that we all do about where he might be, what he might be doing. But it's those sorts of openings, the ragged ends, the things that we don't know about that keep me up at night. So the book, I needed the time to tell the stories, but these are also stories unfinished.
It's a really emotive story. Thank you for telling us about Ibrahim and his son. It's a strange thing to be thinking about, like, yeah. I mean, I assume you've no way of knowing. You'll never find out.
Yeah, that's true. And I think we don't talk about that enough. So when you get the journal articles or you're reading the book, we are put into an artifice, you know, which is that the loose ends have been tied up. These are the conclusions. And that whole way of telling a research story and a way that is a modality that is rewarded by funding and certain cycles of funding. And if you think about the huge pressure on people now, particularly in the UK, researchers to get funding, to get more funding, and we really have to slow down. We have to show funders that actually, you know, 3 years is not enough if you're lucky to get that funding. And the fact that most people, particularly we come to precarity of academia now. And so for early career researchers, particularly, they're having to move on from one project to another. Often they don't get paid for the writing up bit. You know, so there's structural issues again in terms of how we do and practice research that are really part of this problem. So how can you say when your project's funding period is finished, actually there's lots of this we don't understand, or, you know, these papers are going to be inadequate if we produce them now, but we've said in our timeline we'll produce 2 articles within year 3 and that's what we're going to do. So I'm very enamored with and struggle with the idea of slow academia. It feels so, so important to me, and particularly in terms of recognizing precarity, care responsibilities. So I was on lots of very short contracts after my PhD. I mean, it took me more than 10 years before I got a permanent position. And so this all feels very, very real, and it seems even more so now.
Thank you for sharing that. I think it's really important for lots of our listeners who are starting out as well to have that kind of honesty about how it's so easy to assume when someone's more senior than you that they've kind of had an easier time of it. And of course, that's certainly not been the case. So thank you for letting us know. Now, some of your ethnographic work with end-of-life care professionals has led you to use the metaphor and a story of the magic mattress when you're teaching care professionals. So could you tell us a bit about this work with care professionals and how that story features and what that is?
So this goes back to St. Christopher's again, I think. So when I'd finished my PhD research and I was still very involved in St. Christopher's. And I love social theory. So I was imagining sort of carrying on the work with some abstract theorizing in some way. And they weren't really having any of that. They were, hang on a minute. You know, how about you doing some teaching, for example? And they have an MSc that's jointly run with King's College London, an MSc in palliative care, which I was teaching on from about 1998, I think. And that was really that close contact. So I've maintained my working relationship with the hospice all this time from the mid-1990s when I started doing my PhD. And I've been really interested in teaching and how I might translate some of my work into something that would be helpful or a resource for care professionals. So more recently on that MSc in palliative care, I've been teaching a session on narrative medicine. And this approach has been developed in the US by Rita Charon. There's a team in Colombia called the Narrative Medicine Team. And I went and did a short course with them as well. But I've really always been interested in how you turn stories into issues. And so that was always there in my work. I love listening to people's stories. And the magic mattress story, I guess, is an example of narrative medicine for me. So this came out of research that I was doing separately from my PhD. And I was talking to care professionals about how they care for people who are older from racialized minorities. And I, again, really remember, there's lots that I don't remember, but I remember this day where I went to interview community nursing team that were based in South London. And their team was based in really not anything more than a porter cabin, you know, a series of porter cabins strung together. And it was very busy. And I went to do a small group interview with some of them. And it was during this interview that the team leader was talking about a couple that they were caring for. And she told me this couple were originally born in Jamaica. The husband had prostate cancer and they'd been quite suspicious of care professionals. So the wife had really wanted to do as much caring for her husband as possible. And as the nurse was talking, it was clear she was also talking about the need to build trust with them. And she, when she did their visit, one of her colleagues had gone before and the husband had developed this cough at night. And she said to me, I think the cough is about him being worried about dying at night. So they'd offered to give him something to help him sleep. And he'd said, oh, no, there might be a fire and I won't be able to get up. So he was kind of pushing away care. And at the time, the couple were sleeping in a double bed. And the nurse had said, you know, it was getting to stage in his cancer where it was also quite uncomfortable for him to be in a normal mattress. And she talked about the need to get what she called a highfalutin mattress, a pressure-relieving mattress. And at the time, they predominantly came in availability for single beds. And she asked the wife, what will you do if we get the mattress? And the wife said, oh, I'll sleep on the floor beside him, you know, I'll sleep beside him. And she said she went back to the office and she put in a lot of work to try and find a mattress, a pressure relieving mattress for a double bed. And what she said to me was that her inkling was that the bed would also be a trust building. But the wife had said to her, we've slept together for over, you know, 60 years, I think. And her inkling was that the bed would be a kind of a bridging of time in lots of different ways. It would give them an extra 3 to 4 months of sleeping beside each other. And in that time would also be an opportunity for the care team to build up trust with this couple. And so it was really beautiful because a very practical thing, a mattress, is going to extend, I talk in the book about it, extending love's time. And that mattress isn't going to show up anywhere in terms of a care practice that extends time. The time the nurse spent trying to track down this mattress, I mean, I don't think it's even going to be obvious to her colleagues what that mattress did. So there's something about the materiality of care, the magic of everyday objects, that was so beautifully storied, but also practiced by her. And that's, you know, again, what I feel so privileged to sometimes witness is these beautiful dimensions of end-of-life care.
And you've written elsewhere and argued that the most receptive care is riskily artful, sometimes stealthy, including what the English poet and Dr. John Keats called negative capability as being able to tolerate uncertainty and mystery. We're really interested in that idea of tolerating uncertainty as a kind of valuable skill set. So can you share your thoughts a little more on that for us, please?
Yeah, so there's two aspects to that. So there's risk, first of all. So I think we probably know this from research or teaching or any of our relationships that we're involved in, actually, that sometimes risking doing something new or different, trying something, can be when you really extend the everyday or what you know. And in relation to negative capability, so this is the capacity to hold doubt, mystery, I think that really comes across in what I've called the magic mattress story. The nurse can't say this definitely had a huge impact on their quality of life, because we don't measure quality of life in relation to love or what it's like to spend 3 more months next to your beloved. And so there's something about the not knowing, which means really what I'm talking about is the grabbing or the imperative to make legible, where legible means measurable. There's something about that that feels really important. So I'm not advocating for let's make this all transparent, which is one argument, because I also think there's some things that we can't make transparent. We can't pin down and measure within an inch of their life. You know, we can't do that. And there's something that's really valuable that I'd like to hold open space for those kinds of practices. But it's becoming increasingly harder within the audit cultures in which we live. So not just in terms of care practices, you know, if we think about those carers who provide home care, their visits are measured in time. They have to do the 15-minute come in, you know, change somebody, get them dressed, and they have to be out onto the next visit. And we see this in universities as well in terms of work allocation models, for example, that you have 2 hours to prepare a lecture. And that's how long it takes, apparently. So I think there's something about the non-obvious or the non-rational, I should say, that is such a vital part of all our organizations. So what feminists call affect, non-conscious emotions, or, you know, atmospheres, things that slip through the fingers, all of those are things that we're constantly responding to, but perhaps in registers that can't be rationalized or can't be measured. And I don't want to romanticize about this, because that means that lots of work goes unrecognized, but certain people's work goes unrecognized too. So I think it is problematic, and we need to address that. But I'd also want to preserve some space or force open some space for the magic, I guess.
And you've written elsewhere as well on art aesthetics and research and how artistic representations like images, poems, music, literary writing, live dramatic monologues can be used to convey research findings. Can you speak to us a bit about your interest in using artistic representation as a way of sharing research and their value in that context?
Yes, I'm not an artist, and I think my work has really been enriched with collaborations with artists, particularly in end-of-life care. My work has really been endowed by working with art therapists. And I think that conversation in mortality with Ali Iso is also rich in terms of what, you know, examples of what art can do. And I think to get really practical, I guess, for a moment, in terms of what I've seen, particularly in hospice care, and this is hospice care in terms of it being in a building. So hospice care happens in all different ways. But when I was doing my PhD, as part of my ethnography, I was volunteering in the daycare centre in hospice. And I was working in a pottery group at that time. And I think I was just really able to see how conversations, very deep and profound conversations, could happen around, for example, people making pots or sculpting things. And there's something about being together in a group, people talking about each other's illnesses, noticing when someone didn't come to the group, that art was able to do in a way that I couldn't perhaps get at when I was in an interview facing someone face to face. So I think art provides a protective space, really, where you can explore, or you might be able to face things that are so difficult that you can't put them into words, or maybe there aren't the words or vocabulary in which to express something that you might do in a painting, for example, or you might do in writing a poem. So I think art has this capacity because it's able to do things like hold contradictory feelings. It's able to hold the non-linear temporalities, the fact that I'm here with you at this moment, but we might be thinking of different things because something I've said might have triggered something. And I'm really interested in this capacity for disappearance. So Heidegger dropped this kind of bombshell, metaphysical bombshell, into Western philosophy about 100 years ago, which is that we all have this capacity for disappearance. So his work was very concerned with being. But I think in end-of-life care, there is that usual capacity for us to travel out of our bodies, for example, to be pulled away. But then there are very organic processes. So organ failure, for example, the buildup of toxins in the body or the result of drugs, where your biochemistry is changed. So experiences of time become and presence become very complex and interesting. And I think art has this way of holding multiple temporalities that we can't necessarily do in the written word as well, for example, or in talking. And art can gesture to that. It can point us to our own limitations and contradictions. And it can also gesture to the not yet. So thinking about maybe utopias and what might be possible, what might be denied. So in that article, Immortality, I talk about the work of Donald Rodney, who was an artist who appeared in a book by Mark Seeley and Stuart Hall, the black sociologist Stuart Hall, whose work was really trying to show the ongoingness of colonialism. And he was somebody who died of sickle cell anemia, And he was working with the materials, literally the fabrics of his own body and of his care. So x-rays, hospital sheets, blood, all of those things. And I think there's something very profound about the materiality of that work and of art that can allow us to think and feel in ways that can be liberating.
As you say, I have a million ideas and things that I'm tagging along, thinking, yes, I agree, and I've seen that as well. I like what you said earlier about certain forms of care aren't really measurable, and I've had that with my PhD looking at the UK end-of-life care policy and its focus on dying at home. And I really much take from literature that looks at homemaking and seeing home as a verb, and I definitely see that magic mattress as like a form of homemaking and creating a comfortable place and environment. And that's perhaps linked to our next question around your interest in hospitality and what intellectual hospitality is and what hospitality can bring to end-of-life care and the limits of hospitality. Could you speak to this?
Yes, so it's quite a big question. And I think hospitality is very much of the moment, particularly when we think about the refugee so-called crisis that's been happening. The British government, people who might not know, has been really trying to implement a hostile environment policy for not just refugees, but actually it's splashing back over people who might be here legitimately, or who might be black or brown, or who might speak English with an accent. You know, so the matters of hospitality and hostility and hospitality are really bound up with each other. And this goes back to continental philosophy, so the work of Derrida, who was very fond with going back to root meanings of words. And his work on hospitality is really saying how, if we look back at the root meaning of hospitality, it absolutely includes hostility. So hospitality for Derrida balances on a knife edge almost. It's always threatening to tip over into hostility. And so there's been some wonderful work. My thinking's really been broadened by some collaborations with the geographer Nigel Clark, who had a collection with his colleagues at the OU in the journal Paragraph on hospitality. And they really condensed some very, very difficult philosophy from Derrida and Emmanuel Levinas. And my understanding of what they do when they bring those philosophers into conversation with each other is that they say hospitality is about the giving of time and space. So that's my very crude version of what I think hospitality is from the philosophical discussions. But we really see this playing out very much in terms of end-of-life care and in our organisations. And so I've been working for a few years now with Professor Fatina Farahani at Stockholm University, who had a project called Cartographies of Hospitality, which was looking at how refugees and migrants were settling in different host societies. And so as part of that work, I did some research with those people who are called volunteer hosts. So these are people who open their homes and have somebody who is seeking asylum or whose migration status might be in a situation which is not certain, and the person comes and lives with them. So I was doing research with these volunteer hosts and was just really struck about how hospitality plays out in terms of the everyday. And there was an interview that I did at that time, which is, I guess I also want to claim that as palliative care. So palliative care, we often think about in terms of buildings or places. But I think as we can see during the genocide that's happening in Gaza now, palliative care is everywhere. So for me, Gaza has been turned into a hospice, a cemetery, and a mortuary. And, you know, there are people, children, the children who are collecting body parts, the poets, the journalists, they're all palliative carers. But this work that I was doing with hosts, I just remember one man that I was interviewing, and he was telling me a story about a Sudanese migrant who he was hosting in his house. And it was about 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning, and this man's wife had gone into labor. They were in the desert somewhere, and they were on this glitchy phone, and the baby had died while she was giving birth. So there was this man in a British city in Oxford with his host, the only person he knew. They were on a phone line that was cutting off. And his first child had just died. His wife had a really difficult birth, and they didn't know whether she was going to survive or not. And this host had to sit with and bear witness to this while this was happening in real time. And that really struck me, this standing by of somebody, not knowing what's going to happen. But also, it absolutely wasn't empathy. So empathy is often about, we talk about it very reductively as walking in someone's shoes or being able to feel what someone is feeling. And what struck me about the hospitality in that story was taking up the difference that lies between people. So moving into a space where, you know, there's your difference is really there, but being able to sort of stand by someone in that situation. And I see that, I absolutely want to claim that as palliative care, because it was a situation of death, it was a situation of loss, and it was this emotional standing by. And so for me, all those things are about the hospitality, and in a way which transforms space and time.
Absolutely beautiful. I love the way you tell your stories and like give your examples. I can just listen to you forever. And you are talking about hospitality going beyond certain places and borders. And the next question, I think we are bringing it back to a certain space, because in the journal Body and Society, you describe a nurse's account of noisy morning in a multicultural hospice ward. So could you talk a bit about this notion of noisy morning?
Yes. So that article was again about something I'd been thinking about for a long time, which was a story that came up repeatedly during my research, which was about the multi-sensory layers of care and multicultural policies in particular. So we can have multicultural diets, you know, we can have prayer rooms, and those are very nice, thank you, and manageable. But there's something about an unruly multiculturalism that sets up dilemmas for, again, hospitality or tolerance, we might say, in another register. So I kept hearing about, and this was in hospitals as well as in hospices, how when people take up space that isn't necessarily allocated to them, that this is problematic. And again, I want to be really sympathetic, so I don't want to caricature this, because when people are dying, sometimes we can become hypersensitive. So you might often hear that people's hearing is the last sense to go. But also certain drugs, again, how people are being treated can make them hypersensitive to sound. So this is a real problem. And what I was hearing was that there was a certain normalization or a certain British norm about what a good death and good mourning is. And a nurse said this very clearly to me in the same critical way that I'm telling this. And she said she's aware that in the hospice she was working at, a good death means, you know, someone dies without pain, but that there is a nuclear family around the bed weeping beautifully and quietly, you know. And so when 15 people come in, or they're coming in every, you know, there's a whole procession of people coming in, but on the point of death where there's ululating or keening or huge amounts of noise, that becomes really problematic. That's the sort of breaching of a certain multicultural somatic norm that creates problems. And so I was really interested in thinking of the multisensory. And again, we're coming out of the rationality of, you know, Descartes' mind and body split. And I was trying to do some research on hearing, and it was very, very complicated. But I remember reading this neuroscience paper really on hearing, and I think I only understood probably two sentences in it. But chemically and physiologically, what hearing seems to come down to is force. So I was interested in thinking about how hearing becomes difficult in terms of the breaching of all sorts of Euro-centered ideas about body and space. So the idea that, you know, we don't have earlids, really, we can't shut out sound, so we're uniquely vulnerable. So I was interested in what that bodily vulnerability also can stand in for a certain nationalized vulnerability, a certain cultural vulnerability, and also pose these particular problems. So I wanted to take that dilemma about, okay, what do we do? We want to absolutely respect cultural differences, but in a small space, this is really difficult. So it was a working through, and it wasn't a solution, but it was really flagging this up to say, great that you've got a menu that's got chicken tikka masala on it, or an option for kosher food or vegan food. But actually, there's some things that you're leaving carers very unsupported around, which are these things that are bracketed out. So I've been very interested in the sensuality of cultural difference.
Yeah, I often get the feeling that people try to, quote unquote, get diversity, but then it's, oh, we do need to have like a menu of like, oh, this is a woman from Sri Lanka. This is what they'll probably like. This is the person from this place. This is probably what they like. I live in Finland. I'm from the Netherlands. And even like Finnish people love their silence. And I have noted that when my nephews and family are visiting, how loud Dutch people are compared to Finnish people. But then I think even Dutch people are not really that loud, and in those kind of spaces would be expected to be like solemn and quiet. And I, listening to you so far, I've also really admired how you link a lot of your research to, well, your personal experiences, but also current affairs and like the genocide in Gaza and everything that's happening there. And you have stated that you would like to think that an unambiguously anti-colonial deaf studies would have the capacity to bring its intellectual and empirical resources to climate politics. And you share that you'd like to explore in future research the capacity for healing justice when stretched out from your particular research field of palliative care, and then reach on to the climate. So are there any plans in the near future to do that?
Yes, I would like to come back to the unfolding genocide in Gaza. So we're speaking now in the, you know, first week of April in 2024, nearly 6 months into the genocide. And I must say that I am perplexed, worried, I'm very angry about the silence of the palliative care community on what's been happening in Gaza. And there are other genocides as well that are happening. But I think this is probably the most broadcast, real-time genocide that the world has ever witnessed. It's clear to me that this is a matter of a palliative care emergency. And I've seen some prominent palliative care doctors talking about going to Ukraine. One doctor who's quite active on social media spoke initially about Gaza and then she stopped. And this is really worrying. So for, again, for people who are listening who might not be aware, that for me, when I wrote In Death and the Migrant, I was doing some work on the Cicely Saunders archive. Cicely Saunders has been credited with establishing St. Christopher's and therefore the modern Eurohospice movement. And so I was doing some work in her archives, and it was really clear that her ideas for the hospice were very much developed in the shadows of the Holocaust. So she tells a story about how her ideas about hospice care developed in her conversations with a dying Polish Jew, David Tashmar, who she was looking after, who at the time bequeathed her £500 to set up the hospice. But in doing that research, I was really struck by how many radical care initiatives in Europe developed after the Holocaust. And I posed a question about whether the model, the hospice philosophy of total pain, was a reversal of the total annihilation that we'd seen visited by fascism. So I was asking whether hospice care and the total pain idea was a reversal of the violence of the death camps and the Holocaust. So for me, what I'm seeing now is, and again, I haven't written about this, but an idea I have is that every genocide rearranges care and rearranges palliative care. So we are seeing mass killing, mass maiming, towering scales of loss and trauma, also ecocide. So to come back to this notion of the environment, I have a really expansive notion of what the environment is. But, you know, the bombs that Israel has been dropping on Gaza just in the beginning of the genocide, there are bombs that are called J-dams. They haven't actually been telling us what artillery they've been using. But very early on, I was reading reports that the equivalent weight of bombs that they'd been dropping were the equivalent of atomic bombs that had been dropped on Hiroshima. And so if we also think about the entanglement between empire and genocide and ecocide, so when Columbus colonized the Americas, so 1495, around that time, there's some really interesting work by Mark Maslin and colleagues from University College London, who found that the devastation caused by Columbus's colonization, which involved genocide of Native American people, indigenous people, and also their bringing of disease. So there was huge amounts of death, which resulted also in people not being able to tend to land. But this actually affected the world's climate. So colonialism is literally under our skin, whether we like it or not. And this, for me, is happening now in Gaza. To see this beautiful country, this nation, just completely razed to the ground, that this is going to lead to environmental destruction for all of us, or damage. You know, we cannot contain, as climate science is showing, we can't contain what happens in one part of the world from what happens elsewhere. And so for me, this is, I guess, an example of how I can see palliative care, what an anti-colonial palliative care might be doing, which is having a multi-scalar analysis to be able to join up the fact that genocide, ecocide, cholasticide, they are all related. So this is total pain for me. Why have a model of total pain when you're not doing that joining up at a structural level? That is a real example for me of what an anti-colonial palliative care might look like. So we're moving out from the bedside. We're moving into the rubble in Gaza. We're moving to see, you know, the work that journalists are doing, for example, as palliative care, as much as the poets and the artists who are charting what's happening. And I feel just really sad and rageful that the British palliative care community has been so silent about this when they have the skills, you know, very practical skills that they could be lending. So people might know that recently Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitar has been elected as the rector of Glasgow University, who's a British surgeon who's been working in Gaza. And he, for me, is like the new Fanon. He has been doing this work of saying how care is absolutely linked to everything. And I was reading an interview with him, and he was talking about triaging patients in Gaza and how that's changed during the genocide. And he's a surgeon, and surgeons are very, you know, they're not seen as being the most emotional. They go in there, they operate. And he was saying, we now triage patients according to who's left in the family. So it's not just the wound or the body that needs repairing, but we say, is this last child that's left for his or her mother? And then they triage according to that. And that, it's heartbreaking. But he is the only person at the moment who I can look to who is making these arguments, who's piecing together. He's having to piece together a referent, a sign for what's happening. And that's really what good palliative carers do. So pain, for example, is often seen as lacking a referent. So Elaine Scarry's work, you know, was saying that pain broke language. And when we're in situations of what the philosopher Miranda Fricker calls epistemic injustice, that means cultures don't have the words or the hermeneutic resources to give a name to a certain experience, then you need people to do the work of putting together symbols or language that will help people to give some recognition to their experience. And I think that's what good palliative care is. That's what the magic mattress is about. You know, it's about saying pain can be expressed in all these ways. And sometimes we need to do that work where we're not sure, but we're going to give it a go anyway. And so I'm really grateful for Dr. Abu Sitar for doing this palliative care work. And I'm just really urging palliative carers to do the same.
Thank you for this. And I also, I follow you on Twitter as well, and I see you sometimes share your experiences and thoughts and around this topic. And I admire you for doing this, like, in the moment, because even like us at the Death Studies podcast, we are still, I feel, on the sidelines of things, or sometimes talking to people on their topic and not particularly on what is actually happening right now at this point in time. So thank you so much for this. And we were also wondering, like, how do you then, what, when you are doing all this work and all this important thinking around this topic, how do you take care of yourself? Because we've noticed you're also a yoga teacher, and we were wondering, is that perhaps a reason for being a yoga teacher, or to move away from that?
Yes, I'm actually a yoga and a mindfulness teacher. This is very much very astute in making that point. I think it all is linked. And doing this work of being so close to death and loss isn't easy. And I guess since my parents died, life's become a very serious business, you know. So when you're immersing yourself in stories and around people and seeing, I guess we become much closer to death than most people would. That does take its toll. And when I was doing my PhD, and again, perhaps this is some advice, I set up what I called emotions in fieldwork supervision sessions with Colin Murray Parks, who died recently and who's a real pioneer in bereavement studies. So I was so lucky. And also to say at that time, I mean, Colin was incredibly busy, but he said, yes, you know, he was, so that work was not recognized. So he was meeting me every month and I wanted to record those. So I recorded them and I wanted to treat them as data in that way. I wanted to be able to talk through things and not just it be something that was okay. You just, that's the price you pay for working in death studies. And he was really, really good in setting up and enabling a space where I could go and I could talk through things that were happening in my ethnographic research at the time. And he was able to hold that space for me and sometimes offer advice or questions. But there's that side of the emotional toll. But also, I think most of us who work in academia know that it's a very difficult place to work in. There's a culture of overwork. And so that has been something that I've really struggled with. So I, particularly when you're early on and there's in your career and there's so much to do, it's very difficult to keep boundaries. So, you know, you do work late. I still have a really bad habit of working very long days. And as I'm getting older now, like, I don't bounce back so quickly. And the, you know, doing, there's something about the repetitiveness, the fact that we sit down a lot of the time, we're hunched over our laptops, we're staring at screens, that does have a bodily wearing away. I have really wanted to do something about that. My mum introduced me to yoga when I was very, very young. So probably about 9. I certainly haven't done it regularly, but there came a point where I was doing yoga just to help with the tight shoulders and, you know, all the other things, bad backs that academics have, and then becoming more interested. So yoga isn't just about the physical side. There's different aspects of the practice, pranayama, which is breathing, and then also studying yoga and some of the ideas. Yoga is a philosophy. So I really wanted to explore that more, but I also wanted to not work as much. So having to do yoga literally means I have to stop. So that sounds not very healthy, does it? But I think for me, I had to have something, an excuse to get away. And sometimes it's really hard to create the space to practice. So I teach a class once a week, which is really great. But it's really hard to find time to practice. But every time I just, there's a moment when I'm like, oh, I don't want to practice. No, go on. No, no. And then there's a moment when I force myself to get to the mat and I unroll the mat, and there's a point in which I throw the mat up in the air and flick it open. And oh my God, it's that point which is just wonderful. And there's never been a time where I regret practicing. You know, it's all the just dragging myself to practice. But once you get there and I actually feel better. Well, you know, what a surprise. But it's the expansiveness I think it gives me. And when you're doing things like balancing, you can't really be thinking about honing that paragraph, or, you know, there's something about the physicality of it, of having to really be present, that I think I find really, really important. And then also in teaching, I've been trying to develop what I call a sort of liberatory somatics, and recognizing that when we teach, there's much more stuff going on in the classrooms than just thinking. And so bringing in things like breathing space practices into teaching, or offering, like I do, some very short yoga or mindfulness sessions with my students. And that is really important in terms of coming together as a different community of practice. You know, I might, for example, do a short reading or a poem, and I might have developed a short yoga practice around it. And so coming together, and this is work that's being developed, particularly by Black feminists, you know, that's nothing new, but we're very staid in how we teach. So I've been really influenced by the work of Alexis Pauline Gums, and who has been doing some incredible work during the genocide. She's a Black feminist who used to be an academic who actually left the university. And she has been holding space open for all the pain and healing that's been happening during the... She has just been constantly showing up in ways that I think are really important and creating space. And sometimes she just reads a poem, just in inverted commas. But it's, again, bringing us in to connect mind and body. And yeah, so I'm really grateful for the work that people have been doing around me. Feluke Taylor is another one, somebody who you interviewed, and everybody who's listening, go and listen to that podcast. It's a beautiful, beautiful interview. But Feluke also does this work which recognizes minds, bodies, you know, and I guess yoga is just my way of doing that sort of work.
You've been talking about, like, academia has this culture of overwork, and especially if you have a topic, you often choose topics you feel passionate about, want to do a lot around, and work as hard as you can and get a lot out of it. And you've shared with Bess that you also have ADHD. So we were wondering, how do you, with all the work that you're trying to do and like living your own lives, like how do you manage all of what you're doing whilst also having that diagnosis?
It's really difficult. I think also there's very different ways in which ADHD can show up in people's lives. And for some people who are neurodiverse, working in a university can actually be quite a hospitable place to work in. So it can be better, for example, you know, than working on the shop floor or working in a hospital, maybe. So I think it really depends on how your ADHD symptoms or your neurodiversity or your disability shows up in your life. And that, of course, changes as well. So I'm also very aware I'm getting older, you know, and then there's what we talked about how academic work takes its toll on bodies. So my ADHD, I think, it's very apparent in how I write. So the fact I write and think very slowly, and that is a crip time that is way outside metrics. So while I might be given 2 hours to prepare, I think it's 3 hours for a new lecture and 2 hours for re-teaching an established lecture, it generally takes me about 5 days, maybe longer, to put a new lecture together, because I have to read. I have to think through how I'm going to teach. I have to understand. I have to make sure that I'm creating a space that is both challenging but also offers some stability for people who might need it. And all of that can't be rushed. And so I'm very, very, very slow. I had years of just being very angry with myself, thinking, why can't I be faster? Why can't I write quicker? Why can't I prepare my teaching in ways that are very clear, but also not so inefficient? So inefficiency is how I saw my work being characterized by. And I think I have different aspects. So just to talk through things, like one ADHD symptom is often ADHDers can have very poor sleep patterns. So I struggle with insomnia. And then if you do, so this is also not helped, I should say, by working late, you know, so it's like I think Mel Chen, who's a career theorist, their idea of brain fog is really, really helpful because it crosses the physical mental divide. So I also had long COVID, which left me with brain fog. You know, and I don't know whether brain fog for people who are neurodiverse, the effects of long COVID are worse, or so it's very confusing. There's also hormonal changes. So for women, for example, you know, the just monthly cycles or the menopause can really affect symptoms of brain fog. So these are all, again, interrelated, but I find that things can just flow into each other. So for me, if I've got lots of work on, then I'm working later, I'm taking fewer breaks, I'm not looking after myself, my sleeping is not good, everything gets slower. So the next day, I know, like, going to bed early would help, but there's something about, oh, if I could just stay here and I might just finish off doing those emails, or I just lose that care for my own self. So I think it's been a difficult kind of journey in getting used to how symptoms might change and to new environments as well. So changing job for me, going from one university where I was very, very happy and had lovely colleagues, and then going to a completely new setting after a long time made everything worse. But it was also during the pandemic. So I think for me, it is something about how I perceive myself as being much slower or much more inefficient, and having to constantly check myself about that to be kinder to myself, which is, again, as we've spoken about, very difficult within the organizational environments of universities, but also, I should say, during times of political crisis. So, you know, been doing work on Palestinian solidarity, for example, and I'm very aware that certain black or brown women particularly are doing a lot of that work, which is added on to the usual work that we're doing and can be more exhausting too. So there are all these things that I think we need to take account of and which are really important in terms of confronting how ableism can leach into our everyday world.
And I think that leads nicely into our final question, which is, I think you've already started it, but do you have any advice or pearls of wisdom about any topic that you wish to give some advice on? We always love some advice.
I think you've probably just heard how I'm the last person to be giving advice. But I think for me, the one piece of advice I would give is to try and prize open some time every day to connect with your body. And this might be having a cup of tea or coffee where you're doing nothing else. You know, you're just focused on enjoying that. It might be daydreaming. It might be going for a walk. For example, going for a walk can be really nice, and paying attention, you know, not just a useless walk, I would say. So not a walk that, oh, I've got to go and post a letter or I've got to do this, but maybe just a walk where you're going to the end of the road for no particular reason, or going to a green space. So it might also mean just taking a mindful breath. So just breathe. I think that sounds really obvious, but, you know, breathing is so important for our vagus nerve, our rest and digest sort of neurosystem. So I think just when things are bad, maybe you can't get away, maybe having a cup of coffee or a tea feels impossible, taking a big round of mindful breathing where you're just focusing on maybe doing some autoethnography, you know, noticing how the breath comes in, how is it feeling today, how is it going out, what's the texture, what's the pace, those sorts of things can be a moment in which we can snatch some time back and also open up some space in our body minds.
Well, Jasmine, thank you so much for talking to us today and for sharing all your stories and your personal experience and also some advice that I think will be helpful to some people.
What a wonderful interview. It was such a privilege to talk to Jasmin and really have a conversation that was just so rewarding. And I've commented several times to Lenska on how much I value and appreciate how careful and like full of care she is with language. The word choices, the thought that's gone into the language that's used, I really admire. And I was joking to Lenska that many years ago, I had some training from this like amazing public speaking expert guy. He was really good. And I had to do a bit of public speaking in front of him. And it was absolutely my worst ever public speaking. I've probably, well, maybe it's up there with my worst ever public speaking I've ever done, because I admired him so much that I completely was unable to put into practice anything I'd learned from him. You were saying you also have a lot of admiration in particular around academics who are able to engage so much in activism.
Yes, definitely. I find it so important. And with, well, Jasmine in particular now, how she is engaged with the genocide in Gaza and what's happening there, and very critical of the palliative care community in the UK in her case, but I think in other places as well. And I've had it, well, since the pandemic, I would think that so many people jump on top of certain things whilst they are happening. So as the pandemic was unrolling, and with any kind of conflict, or there's horrible things happening in Sudan and in many places of the world. And I always wonder at what point, yeah, do I feel confident enough to have a voice, to tweet something, to say something, and to do something? And I have several friends who are way more actively activist than I am, but I also have quite an introverted personality. So the thought of going on the streets and march and protest, I would love to do that in the quiet of my own home so there won't be other people. So I really, with Jasmine, the way she puts herself out there and the work that she does, it's definitely something I am thinking about. How can I take that forward in my own life, in my own work? And yeah,
I felt similarly about ideas around slow academia. She was talking about how we approach being part of the academic community, taking the time in an environment where you're just not given the time to do that, like, sense making that takes so long, of data that you've collected, of thinking things through in different ways, of having the space to ruminate and to explore an idea and to read. So little time to read. I really struggle with that. The saying yes is quite quick and the saying no is quite slow, and that can be a contributing factor to some of the challenges of the slow academia kind of thing for me personally, in terms of how I might play a part in it myself, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I've done some work in a secure psychiatric hospital in the UK and also in prisons there. And I feel, because of the pressures of funding and just the time limits, we as researchers also sometimes overpromise what we'll do for participants or people who take part. And especially in the secure hospital, when I was introducing the research and what it could be, there was such a skepticism from all the, they have to be called service users, or because they use the service, or patients, that's a whole different discussion. But the people in those hospitals, they were so skeptical about the potential outcome of my research and what it could do. And the same with the people in prison I've interviewed for the cancer study I did, is that it looks really nice on a funding proposal that you're going to do X, Y, and Z. But then to what extent do those things A, happen, and B, then filter down to the people you want to reach or have meaningful change with? So as Jasmin was saying, often there's funding to do the interviews and the work and the research, but then there is no time to write it up. And then you're also kind of expected to do that after your contract has finished. Because like Jasmin, I've also had
I still have a fixed term contract in academia. I have a permanent contract at the embassy, but the academic work is still also temporary. So much of that, I would love to have that slowness and be able to think more carefully. There are so many projects with interesting data, and then they never see the light of day because you have to write the next funding bit or move on to the next thing. Whereas I think there is so much knowledge out there if we would just sit back.
I've been doing some funding bids recently, which I've not really done before. And that idea you're talking about there of not having enough time to do all the things you have to promise you're going to do, or things that you could do with that data, but it's you've had to move on to the next thing. I've been really contending with this idea, I don't know how common this is in other countries, but of funding that only supports direct costs, trying to figure out what a direct cost might be, but what a direct cost definitely isn't, is my time. There's no like list of examples of what that might potentially be. Not only is it that you haven't got enough time, it's that you're not given any time, but the expectation there is that that time comes from an institution, that the institution will provide the time as part of a contract where you're given time for research. But of course, that's so unrealistic given the actual sheer workload that most people are facing.
But also so many funding excludes early career researchers, however you want to define that, because as you say, direct costs are not being paid. So to expect someone to be the PI, the principal investigator, to be someone with a permanent contract already, and then there will be other people. Whereas I think a whole generation of academics is held back because they are not allowed to apply for certain funding, or they have to do it with someone else as the big name on the proposal. And then at the same time, to go back to how we started as well, it just feels so pointless and self-grandizing in a sense, as well as at the same time all these horrible events are happening in the world. Whereas how can academia have that priority, and not how do we make sure that the world is safe for everyone to live in?
Yeah, and it's very gendered too. For example, Yasmin being a carer for like 7.5 years, that is more likely to fall upon women. And unless you've got inherited wealth to the extent that you don't so much have to worry about having an income, it just makes so much nearly impossible. And my partner and I often joke about the difference in our titles. Like, we did doctoral study and stuff at pretty much the same time. The pay discrepancy isn't there. The title discrepancy is there, which is really interesting. And ultimately, just part of that complex landscape of inequality embedded into universities and academia that, like you say, sometimes can seem a bit almost silly when I think about it in comparison to the massive amount of inequality globally. I thought the term unruly multiculturalism is probably one of my favourite terms of all time. And I like the stuff about acknowledging difference as a kind of gold standard of hospitality that's better than empathy, that's something more to really, really recognise difference and not ask people to be the awful, awful word people use in Britain of like assimilate and ugh.
As she was talking about, like also like noisy mourning or grieving, like there are expectations on how you voice your grief or act in a situation or be in a public space, and it's never embraced that, oh, how lovely, the entire family comes to the hospital and they often bring food or there's music, and it's always negative. It's never, oh, what can we learn? Whereas there's also a global epidemic of loneliness amongst older people and people who don't get any visitors. So why are we so negative around the people who do embrace more social contact, etc.? It's fascinating what is embraced and what is pushed away. And I think various cultures can learn so much from each other and bring so much to each other. But it's, oh no, this is the way we've always done it, or you're not expected to do this in a certain environment.
Something I've thought about a lot, but not necessarily applying it to those contexts or to the institutions that are so central in it, in terms of hospitals and how that really shapes people's experience. I think that Yasmin's research is really interesting in the context of institutions and how they function to make places hospitable or not, and how they kind of shift and change, and how a lot of the powerful stories of things being really sort of life-changing were when people were going into the home, like the mattress story. You know, that's a really powerful one that will stay with me.
And to our listeners, we would love to hear what stayed with you listening to this episode. So do tweet, email, leave reviews wherever you listen. And we love to hear, what resonated with you in this episode. And we hope you tune in to the next one as well. Thank you for listening to the Deaf Studies podcast. You can find out more about our guests and their work in the show notes or on our website, thedeafstudypodcast.com. If you enjoyed listening to us, please leave us a comment, follow us on social media, and of course, spread the word.